This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show here on The Orb, is my esteemed co-host and spring wine connoisseur, Mr. Matthew Rushing. Matthew, how's it going?
Well, you know, Chris, it's funny that you say that about the spring wine. Dan and I were talking about the World of Deep Space Nine book just the other week, the Fragments and Omens tome, and actually it's not really a tome because it's a pretty short book, but it was bringing me back to the times when I was trying to get that fledgling company off the ground for spring wine sales, and well, now I'm back and I just really need a bottle of spring wine. I've got to say, those Bajorans, they really know how to make something that will enliven your spirits like none other.
Sounds like a commercial for spring wine.
Oh, Chris, see it on you caught Couture on to television. My game.
Now, let me ask you, when you were trying to get your licenses and your funding and all for the spring wine business, did you have to get in bed with the Circle?
I wouldn't say I had to get in bed with the Circle, Chris.
No, I don't mean literally in bed. I'm not talking like Beryl trying to get Kira kind of getting in bed. I just mean, you know, the metaphorical.
No, it was more kind of the way that Jero and Wynn get in bed together. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, wow. I think that happens at the end of this episode we're going to talk about
today.
Oh,
I'm sure it does. Talk about a bed of evil. Luckily, none of that. I was able to just go down to my local magistrate there in Bajor, and very kind, very nice lady helped me out and, in fact, asked what my prices would be. She's looking for a new spring wine provider for her catering business on the side. So, I mean, just scorn everywhere, Chris.
I have a feeling she knows Quark, too, now that you're getting into catering, but... Anyway, so yes, today we're going to continue our series on the Circle trilogy, talking about the episode that's actually called The Circle. And before we do that, we have a couple of things here that we want to let everyone know about. And the first is, of course, to thank our associate producers here on the show, Ruth Ward, Will Wynn, and Ken Tripp, who make it possible for us to bring The Orb to you. And everyone who's supporting us through Patreon. We are a listener-supported network, so we need your help in keeping The Orb and all the shows on Trek FM coming to you. And you can find out everything you need to know about that by just going over to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And get the information, any help you can provide. We really appreciate all your support over the years here on the network. And also, speaking of the network, we'd like to remind everyone that The Orb is just one show on the network, and we have many, many shows covering every series. We have shows covering science and, of course, books and comics, which Matthew was talking about there a moment ago. as well as music and fan films and independent productions and everything that you can imagine in the world of Star Trek. And you can find all of that by going to iTunes.com/TrekFM. If you're an Apple user, that'll take you right over to our artist section. We are a featured provider with Apple in the iTunes store. And you can also go to our website, trek.fm, and you can grab the RSS links there if you're an Android user. And also apps like Pocket Casts is a great one on Android for listening to the shows as well. And if you're a Windows Phone user, I recommend going to Spreaker, get the Spreaker app, and you can listen to us there as well. And we're also on SoundCloud. So we look forward to hearing from you about our shows and for your support. We really thank you so much. Now, Matthew, let's jump into our continuation of the Circle Trilogy here. And, of course, we start this one off with a recap of what happened last time, and then we jump right in.
Last time on Deep Space Nine.
That's right. And I always love middle stories, you know, like with Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, I'm
probably
with you.
My favorite.
The Two Towers with Lord of the Rings.
Right. And even The Search for Spock with Star Trek is a really great movie for me because I like those middle stories. So how do you feel jumping right here into the second part of this trilogy?
You know, what I liked about this episode and what I thought was really smart is actually, as I was rewatching it today, I was surprised at how much of the story happens in this second part. You know, you don't feel like, you know, you're missing anything. You feel like you're getting so much out of it that it really does just leave you wanting to go to the next one. I mean, it's very much reminiscent to me of that kind of Empire Strikes Back feel where we give you a lot of story and then we do leave you kind of like with a good cliffhanger to make you want to come back for the next one. But you've completed a lot of kind of the storylines that you were starting to tell. So it's very much the middle, but at the same time, it's also doing its own thing. And really, I mean, this episode is rife with just some great character moments and really pushing some characters forward, which is really fun, and character relationships, which is really fun.
Do you feel like with the story that if it weren't a trilogy, in the style that DS9 becomes later on, the way that this episode is resolved, and of course you've got the scene there with Gero and Wynn, which we mentioned a moment ago, and then we've also got Sisko talking to Starfleet, and they decide, let's just get out of here and we'll deal with it later. The story could maybe not be continued in the next episode, but maybe here and there, bit by bit, over the course of a season, and it would still work the same?
That is a really good question, and I don't know. I feel like that this trilogy works best because it's kind of in that what Enterprise would do in its fourth season, where you tell those arc stories, and it works well because what's interesting is they're telling a whole story, but this Circle Trilogy is so much bigger than just these three episodes because they're going to have massive ramifications for the rest of the series and the way it moves forward for a lot of these characters and obviously what's going on with Bajor. And so I think it works better to tell them in three consecutive parts and then allow the ramifications of those to kind of, you know, spill out into the rest of the series, then kind of threading it through. I don't know. I think this, what they decided to do, works a little bit better. And two, makes for a really strong start to the second season.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, each week you're going, oh, I have to come back to see what happens next. You know, what a great way to start a season of a show. Because especially the second season, you're drawing people back in immediately to the first three episodes. And then, you know, that's a habit at that point. You keep going. So,
yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think this particular story works well as a three-parter. And because of Enterprise, largely, I've become very fond of that form of storytelling. My latest column on StarTrek.com is actually about that, taking that format and putting it into the Next Generation. So I really like it. But as we talk about how the story is told in this episode, it is interesting that maybe they could have gone that other route and it would have still worked in the sense that it does give you closure fairly well. And you mentioned The Empire Strikes Back, and you know that story gives you that closure as well. You know something else big is going to happen, and you want to go see what it's going to be, but you could stop there and feel satisfied by the story that was told.
You could. I mean, you'd still be, I think, on the edge of your seat the whole time, kind of waiting for what happens next. So, I don't know. I like the way that this goes, and I'm glad that they decided to tell it this way. But I think it's just a bold statement of saying Deep Space Nine really is going to be very different than TNG. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the last few episodes of the first season and then these episodes of this season, of season two, I think they are very much that pounding of the hammer saying, no, we are going to be different. And we're not going to be afraid of telling some stories that, you know, TNG or even TOS might have kind of shied away from.
Yeah. And the format. So, it was a great way to show that we're going to go in a different direction.
We're going in a different direction. You're being let go.
that's what they told Kira.
Yeah, Jaro's exactly. Like,
Nerys, we're going in a different direction with this whole first officer thing.
We're
going
to go with a Navark, even though we have no idea what that is.
Well, apparently, and did you find this interesting, Matthew? Apparently, the Navark reports directly to the prophets.
Which is awkward because they don't always show up for meetings, so...
Right. Yeah. Plus, you never know what time the meeting is really going to be, right?
That is true. It could have been yesterday and you might have missed it.
Right.
You might not be born.
Where were you? Well, the meeting was yesterday. It's also tomorrow. Why are you here now?
I'm not omnipresent. I can't do this.
Okay, well, different things that happen in this episode, going maybe the order they happen in, that stand out to me, Odo and Kira. I did want to talk a little bit about this because this is before we really get into the whole Odo has feelings for Kira and Kira doesn't know kind of thing. Odo is the most upset person on the station about the fact that Kira's leaving. I mean, maybe Sisko is, but, you know, he's too cool to show it. Odo is just really, really pissed here. Do you feel like it's just the fact that they've been on the station together before the show started in terms of what we know of the storyline? So they have this history, and then he's losing the connection with someone who he feels comfortable with, or is this already a sign that Odo has feelings for Kira and is upset that she's going to be, you know, they're going in another direction?
I feel like this is an all of the above, Chris. I was thinking, okay, who does Odo know the longest in his life other than Dr. Mora? And I feel like it's Kira. And I think that Kira is the very first person that Odo actually trusts in his life, ever. And so that's where I think the feelings for her start to stem from, is the idea that he completely trusts Kira with all that he is. You know, there's not a lot that he hides from her, except maybe the fact that he's not as comfortable with shape-shifting around anyone, even Kira. Yeah. So, I think that is a big part of why he's so angry, because he's losing the only person in his life that he trusts whatsoever. And I think, too, you know, Odo is a founder, and kind of a very fabric of their DNA is this idea of kind of justice, at least it seems to be, for Odo. Mm-hmm.
Well, their own brand of justice.
Well, exactly, their own brand of justice. But Odo seems to have a very strong idea of what that is, and she's definitely being treated unjustly by the Bajoran government right now, and I think that just kind of hacks Odo off. That all of this is happening, and they're taking away his best friend. So don't mess with Odo's BFF.
That's right. I thought earlier you were going to say that he looks at Kira and thinks, you complete me.
It's not quite that Jerry Maguire moment yet. That doesn't happen until season six with his way. But
in my head it was. I was picturing the scene, but with Odo and Kira.
Aww,
and
that's then really maybe sweet, yeah.
And then maybe Odo turns into a sofa because Quark said, you can just turn into a sofa. I've got to leave. You can just turn into a sofa.
Oh, gosh. But yeah, that's a really, it's a really great scene.
And then the room, the voice of the room says, "You complete me."
Whoa, whoa, whoa. The room is talking now?
Right, the room is talking now.
That was the only person who wasn't talking in that scene in Kira's quarters.
Right. Well, that's something that stood out to me with Odo and Kira. But what also stood out mentioning the scene in Kira's quarters is how already we're only one season in. And you remember what the atmosphere was like when everyone got to the station and Kira didn't want the Federation there. And of course, she couldn't stand Bashir at the beginning. And then when you see them all in her quarters here, and then she tells Vedic Barayal, "These are my friends," you can see how they've already come together and become a family in a very short time.
It's like they were all jamming to the Beatles at that moment. Come together. Anyway, yeah.
Well, and I think that that would have attracted Vedic Barayal.
Probably.
He would say, "Kira, can we come together?"
Yeah, he's kind of a weird hippie. Like, anyway, we'll talk about him later.
we'll talk about him later.
I really like that scene because it is kind of a choke you up kind of scene when she says, "These are my," and then she finds the word slipping out of her mouth, friends. It's really... And they all kind of look at her, and I think they all realize it for the first time, just how much Kira means to them. And they're all there in their different ways. Odo's really mad, and O'Brien's just kind of bumbling because he's not comfortable with this kind of thing.
And Bashir's confused, and Quark is hoping to hit on Kira.
Exactly.
She was leaving with his one drink.
Yeah, and Dax is there because they really are friends at this point. They're gal pals, and I think it's a really wonderful scene that, and you mentioned earlier that Sisko isn't there, but then the scene that Sisko and Kira have together is really, really nice because you can see how deep the relationship has become between them and how much trust that Kira has earned from Sisko. Like you never mess with a captain and their crew. And the same thing goes for Commander Sisko and his crew. Don't screw around with the commander and his officers. And he feels that very strongly for her. And I really love that because Kira is not a part of Starfleet, but she's a part of Sisko's family.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you don't mess with the Sisko, and you don't mess with the Sisko's personnel.
No, you do not.
From the very beginning, I mean, Sisko, the way he talks to Jaro, it's like he's seeing right through Jaro at that point. Like, maybe he doesn't know exactly what he's up to. He doesn't know that he's the head of the circle, but he knows there's something not right about this guy. He's very suspicious, I feel.
I kind of think that he's seen this kind of thing before. You feel like Sisko has been around the block, and he's dealing with admirals all the time. Did you notice, was it Admiral Chakotay in this episode?
It was Admiral Chakotay, yes.
But doesn't really look like he's Chakotay's dad. Is this...
No.
Yeah.
Not at all. And, yeah, I mean, I don't know where the name came from. You get these names that come up later. Like, you remember there's that crew member in the Undiscovered Country called Dax.
Yes, yeah.
With the weird feet that can't fit into the boots. And so here we have Chakotay, and then they pull that name out. Actually, not that much further down the road when they develop Voyager. I think that's the thing, is that it's so close together. The name being used here for this completely different character, and then the name being used for a Native American character.
Are we sure that Chakotay is not a shapeshifter and we just never knew it on Voyager?
Could be. That is something that we should explore sometime, I think. Maybe a crossover with To the Journey. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like that this is an unearthed storyline that we've just come up with. And maybe Chakotay really is a changeling infiltrator on Voyager, and we just never found out.
But he couldn't do his job because they got lost in the Delta Quadrant.
And then he fell in love with Kathy, so...
Yeah, that's right. That's why he was making like tubs and buckets and stuff like that when they were stuck on the planet together. Mm-hmm. He needed
exactly.
a bucket.
Yep. That's yeah. really why he made her the bathtub, because he needed it to regenerate.
Okay. Well, this is our DS9 show, so let's get back over. Although I'm sure Voyager fans will be thrilled that we're actually talking about Voyager for once.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. But yeah. So Sisko, yeah, like you said, he's seen this before and he's very suspicious of Jaro. And you can tell, whereas Odo is running around showing his anger and frustration, with Sisko, you can feel it like simmering under the surface, his anger at Kira being reassigned.
This is one of those places where, you know, a lot of people think of Sisko as being a little bit more volatile as a commander.
Yeah.
But I think he really shows his quality here by, you know, especially when he has the conversation with the Bajoran military leader later on, and he treats him with such respect. You know, he doesn't ask for the favor before he gives the information, you know. So I honestly think that Sisko is been studying how to win friends and influence people, because he's really doing a good job of trying to earn the trust of the Bajoran people. And again, I think this really just shows the difference between Sisko and the other captains, that he has some abilities that even a Picard doesn't have, of fostering a depth-filled relationship. He has the ability to foster an in-depth relationship with people and gain their trust for the long term, not just that short-term gain.
Well, I think that's because Sisko can be more of your friend, like one of the guys. He's more like Riker in that sense, where he can be like one of the guys, and so he can build that deeper relationship with someone, whereas Picard is more standoffish as a captain.
Yeah,
I mean, there's no doubt that diplomatically Picard is better equipped than Sisko, but sometimes it's not exactly diplomacy that you need, right? Sometimes it's gaining that trust and getting closer and being friendlier with someone.
Yeah, I think there's an authenticity to Sisko as a person that might not come off with some of the other captains, whereas, you know, what you see is what you get with Sisko. And for most people who are, when we're talking about gaining trust, that's what you gravitate towards, so.
Yeah. Well, let's spend some time exploring Useless, which is what Vedic Barayal asked Kira to do when she was down the planet. Now, first of all,
that's all he was asking for her to do, but
well, no, it wasn't, and that's what I'm going to say. You know, he sees her reassignment as this opportunity to get closer to her, and he whips out all his spiritual pickup lines. He takes her down to his shack on Bajor, and
his monastery, Chris. His monastery.
Oh, is that what it's called? A monastery? All right.
I'm not going to lie, Chris. This is the worst case of God told me to be with you I've ever seen, because well, and they do both have orb experiences that both have each other in them, and so but I do think that this is kind of and it's not that it's a terrible storyline, it's who they have playing the character and the way that he's playing the character.
Yeah, it doesn't work. You know, I'm not a fan of Vedic Barayal. I can see commercials with Vedic Barayal in them starring as the most boring man in the world.
Oh, I like that.
Or the creepiest man in the world. You know, he's just, the way the character is portrayed, it's very creepy. And one thing that I did yesterday, in addition to watching this episode, I just listened to this episode, because I have all the episodes of Star Trek as audio only, because I like to listen to dialogue. And as dead as the delivery is when you're watching the episode, it's even worse when you don't have the visuals to go with it. I don't know if he was told to read the lines that way, or if this is just how he felt, but he comes off as this very desperate, lonely, creepy man that's using his spirituality as a way to get to Kira, because he goes into this whole thing about the orb experience, and you can tell that it disturbs her too. You know, she's like, well, what happened in there? What was I doing? What was your experience about? It's her take on it, because it feels like she immediately is thinking, this is a little bit weird.
It just makes me think of the Elton John song, you know, it's a little bit funny, this feeling inside. And I'm thinking, it is a little bit funny, and it's a little bit awkward.
It's awkward.
It's a lot awkward. Let's be honest. And so it's, I just, the whole way that it's played, if it had been somebody who wasn't talking slower than somebody from the South, and I can say that because I'm from the South.
And I'm from the South.
Exactly.
Too.
So it's just, it's very frustrating because this will be somebody that Kira has that relationship with for a while, and I don't understand it whatsoever. I don't know. Maybe she's...
I don't understand it either. Like, I find it hard to believe that Kira would be attracted to this man, because he doesn't seem to be the type of man that she would be attracted to as such a strong woman. And when we see her down on the planet and she fairly quickly seems to kind of lose herself in the atmosphere, this tranquil atmosphere where she for once can just explore useless, as he tells her, that surprises me too. The whole portrayal of the monastery is a little bit odd for me, and even how Beryl and Wynn talk to each other. What do you make of that?
I mean, I know what they're going for. It's a very, you know, many people go to Catholic monasteries to get away from it all, to unplug, mm-hmm. and you literally unplug. There's, for so many of them, there's...
Well, that part I get, of course. But I mean, being in Japan, being a Buddhist country, we, you know,
right.
It's all about connection with nature. That part I get, but the people there,
I don't know. I mean, apparently all of them are weird, because Wynn is power hungry, crazy, and a real jerk to Kira in the first place. And Beryl seems like a sexual predator from, you know, one of those shows where they get caught.
Right.
So
you think Beryl's going to walk into the kitchen and Wynn is going to be there? And because the impression I got was that this isn't the first time he's done this. Like, the way Wynn talked to him seems like he's kind of got a reputation around the monastery.
Yeah, that's not how I took it at all. I took it as that Wynn does not like Kira. And basically, they're trying to get rid of Kira. And she's just disappointed that Beryl is kind of bucking their plans, at least her and Jero's plans, by keeping Kira anywhere to anyone at this point.
So that's true. That's a good point. After you get to the end of the story and you roll back. Because then we know that Wynn and Jero are working together. When it happens in the story the first time through, though, we don't yet know what the connection is between Wynn and Jero.
Right. Not at least until the end of this episode, when we get to the bed of evil.
Right. At the end of this episode, right. So the way she's speaking to Beryl, for me, it feels like she doesn't like Kira, but it's also like she doesn't like Beryl either. And this kind of animosity between Vedics at the monastery, I kind of see what maybe they're going for, and then how it gets portrayed is different. So, I mean, as you, as a man of faith, and knowing how these relationships would work in real life, is it portrayed well, or what were they going for and they didn't quite hit on?
What I think it's supposed to be, and I kind of pick up that it is that Beryl is an actual man of faith who is not using his faith to try and gain power. And Wynn is kind of known as somebody who does that. And so that's the struggle here, is between somebody who really is trying to help Kira and another person who is seeing people as stepping stones that Kira's been playing with to get somewhere. I think that's really what we're seeing. I think the thing that's clouding it all is the portrayal of Beryl is coming off as so creepy and strange that it's not really helping. Like, if it had been played differently, if he'd been played more as kind of an open, hospitable, very caring person, instead of coming in like a sexual predator, is what he comes off of, unfortunately.
I mean, I hate that we keep using that word, but unfortunately, it does feel that way. And I don't think that's at all what was intended in the writing.
No, not at all.
It's unfortunate that the portrayal leaves that vibe, because he should be like a warm, caring, spiritual man, which I think was probably the intention, because I do think, like you say, that in the situation, Beryl is a spiritual man, Wynn is power hungry.
Yeah.
And so if it had been portrayed that way, I think the story would have worked a little bit better.
Yeah. If it had come off with what they're going for, it would be completely different. And I think it just would have, with maybe a different actor or different direction. And I can't
maybe
really
just direction,
but and I blame the actor, because the direction doesn't seem to be that at all. It just seems to be that this actor kind of plays that every time he's around.
Yeah,
it's like it's like, you know, when you see people trying to play a Vulcan, they a lot of times play it badly. They play it as if there's no emotion instead of controlled emotion. And what I feel like here is he's trying to play somebody of faith who doesn't know anybody of faith. Like, it's like he's never met a priest or a pastor or, you know, a Buddhist monk or any of that. And that's why he's coming off so stilted and strange. So,
but being a Vedic, that wouldn't be the case, because you've risen up higher up into the ranks of the Bajoran faith. So obviously you would have met all of these people already.
Right.
You wouldn't come off
as
like a lonely wanderer trying to find your connection with nature or the prophets.
I think that the portrayal of Kaiopaka in the first season really set the stage for what we'd want to see, which is that kindly, wise, very in touch with her spirituality, trying to help others to be in touch with their spirituality through a life well lived. You know, she's a good witness to her faith, and she's trying to lead others to know the prophets better and know their destiny better through that. So, she set that stage so well and the pedestal very high. And when nobody else is reaching that on the show, that we see the Vedics or, you know, future Kais, it's frustrating because we know what they're supposed to be like.
Mm-hmm. But I will say that dramatically, the show is more interesting when you have someone like Wynn coming in, as opposed to having someone like Opaka. You know, I mean, 7 seasons of Opaka helping people find their faith might not be that interesting dramatically.
Right. And I mean,
in real life, it would be nice.
There is a very good reason that they're telling this story with Wynn, because it has been an issue to have people misuse their faith for power, and it's happened all throughout history. And it's not just people of faith that have misused their beliefs, but it's anybody who's misused power. So I don't want to just say it's only people of faith that can do that. We have all seen the misuse of belief for terrible things for power.
Yeah. Well, that was an interesting exploration of Vedic Beryl there, which I didn't know we were going to go down that path, but that's why we do the show, just to see where our conversations lead. While we're talking about portrayal of characters, I do want to go back to what we talked about last time, which is the casting and the performance of Lee Nahlis. And last time we decided that the portrayal worked for The Homecoming. What about here? Do you feel like you know, here he kind of continues this kind of morbid, sad portrayal, but he comes out of it a bit at times when he starts to take over some duties as first officer. What do you think here? Does it transition well? Does it work? Does it start to feel like maybe he should be a little bit more authoritative or stronger?
I like the betrayal, actually. I was thinking about that specifically. I knew you'd ask the question, and I felt like that here it was strong, the way that he's playing the character, because he is this guy who he has known his whole life that he's this hero. Everybody wants him to be something. He knows why he's in this position. He knows that they're using him. He doesn't know what to do about it. And
he doesn't know why they're using him.
Right. And then so he's in this very frustrating place, but he also does want to help. And that's, I really like that little conversation that he and Sisko have. Do you want me to come with you? Sisko's like, no. Is there anything I can do here? You know, he wants to be useful, you know, in the same way that Kira wants to be useful, and she's frustrated about being useless. And this guy is like, I'm being thrust into this position. I know I shouldn't be here. I know I'm replacing somebody who's actually good at it. I want to do something, and I know that I can do something because, you know, Kira brought him here for a reason because she thought he could help. And yeah, I like the way he's playing it because I think I'd feel the exact same way and be acting the exact same way of like, well, damn it. What am I supposed to do? And playing that is tough without coming off as being as seeing like that you're just not doing a good job with your acting. But I kind of get what he's going for, and I'm thinking the more I think about it, the more I think it personally works. Does it feel okay for you this time, or is it too wishy-washy?
Well, for me, it's an evolution in how I look at this character, because if I go all the way back, I really don't like the portrayal. And over time, as I rewatch DS9, each time I warm up to it a bit. And then, of course, as we talk about it, I warm up to it a little bit more.
Ooh, so like Jake, I'm talking you into Linalis.
Jake and Ezri.
Yeah. I'm rehabilitating Deep Space Nine for Chris.
That's right. I think that it's okay in this one. I get that he's frustrated by the legend that surrounds him that he feels isn't accurate and that he's tired of hearing of, and the fact that he spent all this time in the labor camp. And that he is, of course, a tired person, exhausted from everything that has happened to him in his life up to this point. At the same time, even though the legend isn't what everyone thinks it is, he still was a leader. He still was a strong fighter. And when he's put into the position of being the first officer on the station, I guess I kind of feel like I want someone like that to be able to pull a little more strength up, to be a little bit more authoritative when they're put into that position. It's tough, and I'm not saying that I would personally be able to do that if I were in that situation and I went through what he went through, but just when I'm looking at a character, I think that's sort of what I feel and is the reason why I'm not completely sold on the performance. There is one nuance in the performance that I particularly noticed this time, which I think does show that Richard Baymar is really putting a lot of thought into how he's portraying the character. When he's talking to the freighter captain and he starts explaining what's wrong with the technical systems, you can tell that he's showing that he's been put into this position on the station. He doesn't actually know that much about station operations or technology. He has to deliver this information to the freighter captain, and he kind of stumbles over the words, but not stumbling over it because the actor can't remember the lines or has trouble with the technobabble, but rather that as a person, Linalis isn't comfortable with what he has to work with right now. And I think that he portrays that pretty well in that scene. And that helps me feel like, even though I'm not personally gung-ho on the performance, there's rhyme and reason behind why he's playing Linalis the way he is.
I'm also thinking back to just where he was, you know, last episode, he was rescued from an internment camp.
Right.
And so this guy's world has been turned upside down overnight. Yeah. And it's an interesting thing to watch him try. And like you said, he is trying to pull himself out of that. And I think maybe he's seeing maybe I have the opportunity now to be the hero that everybody thinks I was, you know, that's an interesting thing. And I don't know, as I watched the performance, I'm kind of picturing all these things going on in this guy's mind, and he's still left with, how do I make it happen? How can I get there? You know, like, and like you said, he doesn't know anything about the station.
Right.
Nobody even knows what the hell a Navark is because they made it up.
Right.
So it's he's between a rock and a hard place of trying to make something of himself. So it is, it's an interesting character. And so I'm glad that we're talking and kind of focusing on that, because the more you think about it, the more depth you get to it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I like about Deep Space Nine, is they can hold up to this kind of scrutiny of continuing to really dig into characters. I mean, a very tiny character like Lee Nullis, spoiler alert, he dies next episode. So, but the fact that you can...
You just had to say that now, Matthew.
I know. But I said spoiler alert, Chris. Jeez, it's like saying, I don't mean any offense, but, you know. So, but I do. I think that that's really... One of the benefits of just this show is that there's a lot psychologically going on with this character when you really sit and think about it. And there's a lot for this, you know, guest star to be able to think about too, and try to play it. And whereas I think Lee Nullis is somebody that you will grow to like more and more as we continue to talk about it. Brile, unfortunately, is going to be somebody we continue as we look through the, you know, the characters and the episodes of Deep Space Nine that never going to come around to. So, because he's always played in a way that just, ugh.
It's also an interesting way, I guess, as viewers, we read how characters are written on TV shows, because if I put myself in his shoes and I were in that situation in real life, I probably would act pretty much the same way he does.
Yeah, yeah.
But when we watch characters on TV, somehow we are expecting something different from those characters and the way they're written. And, you know, I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing, because we want realism in our shows. And then yet when we see someone acting in a realistic way, then we sometimes feel like it's a shortcoming of the writing or the acting.
That's a good point. And I think many times we want our heroes or people on TV or anything like that to act better than we would. And then when they don't, it's like, well, I don't like that, you know? And But the same things that make for a better life for us as we learn from mistakes are the same things that work better for character development on a show.
Except if something doesn't work out well, they can always erase it and then rewrite it. We can't do that.
This is true. Or if you're on Voyager, you just hit the reset button and it's fine.
Right. That's right. Okay. Well, let's move on to one last main topic to touch on here for this episode is intervention. We have Cardassians intervening. They are supplying weapons to the Circle, although the Circle doesn't know they're getting them from the Cardassians. And then even after Sisko informs Admiral Chakotay at Starfleet Command that this is going on, Chakotay, not that Chakotay, tells Sisko...
The other Chakotay.
The other Chakotay, yeah. He tells Sisko, pack everything up and let's just get out of there. Because we don't intervene in other people's internal affairs. And after the premise of the show is that the Federation has come in to help Bajor recover from the Cardassian occupation, and Sisko's mission is to prepare Bajor for admission into the Federation, Sisko has evidence that while, yes, there is some internal squabbling, the Cardassians are back and they're trying to play one side. They're trying to play the minister to get themselves back in, to get the Federation out and get themselves back in. The Federation's just going to go, you know what? Prime directive, we're going to leave. Does that really make sense to you that we see how flexible the Prime directive is throughout Star Trek? It seemed like an odd move by the Federation, knowing that the Cardassians are involved.
It's just one bad moral decision after another. I mean, it's really just dumb logic here. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
I mean, Chakotay's like, man, tough break, man. Right? It's kind of like his attitude's like,
yeah, it's right, I'm going to take my ball and go home now. You know?
Yeah.
It doesn't.
That's too bad. We almost had it. All right. Well, you know, let's go find another planet to help.
It doesn't make sense because the Bajorans have already asked for the Federation to be there. And it is clear that they are being played and used. And if the Bajoran people knew about what was happening, which it's pretty easy for them to be able to find out after...
Just go into Bajoran Twitter, man. It's going to be on
yeah,
there.
I don't understand. Well, oh, I know why they couldn't. Because remember, all communications were being blocked with Bajor. So Bajoran Twitter was down, as was Facebook, MySpace,
even
Tumblr.
On the planet it was down?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. So...
I bet Bajoran Pinterest was still up, so people could order some of that spring wine, though.
That's very true, yeah. Which I was glad that it didn't go down then, because business
would
have really suffered.
You would be in trouble,
yeah.
And your business would be wrecked. So.
Yeah, it just, it doesn't, it really is, I mean, it makes for an interesting thing for, you know, does Sisko kind of do the Kirk-like thing where, okay, do I disobey orders and save the day?
But even Picard would do what Sisko did, which is like, okay, I'm going to leave, but I've got to take everything and it's going to take like a week. So by the time I pack, this will all be over anyway.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to have happen. And it continues the episode for one more go. But I think it, the way they set up the episode, you really did need to see this go on one more. You know, you needed to see how they brought down the circle. You needed to see how in the world was and if Wynn was going to survive her, you know, getting into bed with Jarrow politically and everything else.
Well,
there's
you definitely
a lot
need it
going
to continue,
on. Yeah.
But you don't necessarily need Starfleet to say, let's just leave.
No, you don't need that at all.
They could have told Sisko, like, okay, see what you can do there. I'll talk to the council, figure out what our next steps are going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, I think that would have been their better written thing was Chakotay saying, hey, I have to go talk to the council about this. You hold down the fort. I'll get back to you. It's going to take me a while to walk over to the council chambers, you know, kind of thing. Like, I'm going to walk really slowly, you know.
Right.
You know, yeah. Like, it's like when you're a parent.
Two
I'm going to count
forward
to 10.
And one step back until I eventually get there, you know.
So,
when something unexpected and big happens and you decide just to throw in the towel and leave, can we start referring to that as the not that Chakotay maneuver?
I love it. I think that that should be a thing. The not that Chakotay maneuver.
There you go.
I think the actual Chakotay maneuver is trying to score with Kathy, but getting shot down.
Yeah, over and over and over. Yeah. So what about the storyline of the Cardassians trying to get back in by arming the circle? I mean, I think that's a very interesting and very realistic storyline to throw in here to start the second season.
I mean, you're playing on a lot of interesting history, mm-hmm. you know, of secretly funding, you know, the Rand-Contra affair comes to mind, you know.
Well,
the,
I mean, and it's not just America. I mean, this all around the world.
Oh, yeah.
This happens.
I mean, the, you know, the, this is, yeah, I think it plays very well. And it's something that we're so familiar with because of history that it just makes sense. So I really like that they're using that. And again, it's not so specific that you're just going to say, oh, that just reminds me of the Rand-Conjurer affair. No, it's so broad that it reminds you of so many things you've seen in history. So it gives it that more mythic feel, so that instead of being like, say, season 3 of Enterprise, where you're very tied to one part of history, this makes Deep Space Nine continue to be relevant as you watch the Circle trilogy, because you're seeing all these things play out, but not so transparently that you're oh, that's just that point in history. No, it's a little more opaque so that you can continue to draw the meaning from it over and over and over again.
Well, to wrap up here, this will be another topic which we'll probably talk about more next time, but also final thoughts kind of mixed in together here. Kira has a great line. We didn't talk about the fact that Jaro actually has Kira interrogated, taking a page from what the Cardassians did to the Bajorans and using it against his own people, and not only his own people, but the first officer of the station as well. What did you make of that?
It's definitely a very hypocritical thing to do, you know, to use the same tactics that you would have decried, you know, years earlier to gain power. But then to say, oh, but I'm doing it all for the right reason, you know, like, and it's a classic case of giving us a picture of, this is definitely a time when we can say, okay, you're doing the wrong thing for also the wrong reasons, you know, even though he probably thinks he's doing the wrong things for the right reasons.
Well, he probably thinks he's doing the right things for the right reasons.
That's true too. Right. But
it's also, now again, I mean, this happens throughout history, but this was written a decade before we see the same thing happening in our own society, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's again, it's one of those nice parallels that Deep Space Nine has with history.
Yeah. So going back to what I was starting to say there about final thoughts and one more topic, Kira has this great line after she has been interrogated where she tells Jaro, if you want to change the government, you vote to change it. You don't sneak up behind it with a dagger. And this leads us in, we'll talk more about it when we get to the next episode when the actual coup is attempted. But we often talk about Bajor in terms of religion, and here we're very much into the politics. We're very much into the inner workings of the government and what's happening in the society. So what do you think about this aspect of DS9, which I know a lot of fans like? It's why the Circle trilogy is very popular. A lot of fans like this aspect of Bajor more than they like the religious aspect of Bajor.
It's a really interesting thing, especially now, of course, in the United States, we're going through election season again at this moment. And it's tough to see how much the political process has become so devalued by people, because we just kind of see it as being either a popularity contest or being run by all of these people that we think of as kind of being corrupt or kind of having bought their way, or, you know, just the way everything's bought these days, and sold as a commodity, even political power. And, you know, Jaro is just doing it the old-fashioned way, you know. He's doing it the assassinate whoever you need to get power. You manufacture whatever you need to do to get into power, and we see that too often in our world on every political spectrum. No matter what side of the aisle you're on, we're seeing that people are guilty of this all across the board. So yeah, it's. They don't mention this, but it reminds me of just the idea of having kind of a political class you know, mm-hmm. and that's what Jero seems to be kind of a part of. He's a wealthy yeah. family. They have the power, you know, so.
And that's very different than the impression that we get of Bajor in the first season, where so much of the focus is on the spirituality. We hear about the provisional government, but we don't get the feeling that there's so much of a political class. Whereas here, with Jero, also with the military, with the general, you see that there is this entire other layer of Bajoran society, which of course there would have to be. I mean, if they're going to fight the Cardassians, they have to have military capabilities as well and some sort of organization. But it expands Bajoran society, makes it a little bit more well-rounded. The series as a whole still focuses primarily on the spirituality of the Bajoran people. So would you be interested in having it focus more on the political side as well throughout the series?
It would be interesting to have seen a little bit more of that, just because I feel like even at season 7, they still call it the provisional government. Like,
yeah.
7 years later, still can't figure this government
still
thing
provisional.
Out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that just became the official name of it. You know, like you've got the Congress in the U.S., you've got the Duma in Russia, you've got the Diet in Japan, and they've just got the provisional on Bajor.
I guess, and maybe they were smart enough to say, everybody here is provisional. You are not serving for more than, say, 2 terms. So,
see, now that would be smart. Yes.
Yeah. So,
that would be smart.
Maybe
here's your provisional office. Here's your provisional intern. They could leave tomorrow. You don't know. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll talk more about the political side next time. So any other final thoughts here on this part of the story?
I like this part of the story. I really love all the character moments, specifically, well, I don't like all of them, but I really like the character moments with Kira and everybody on the station until Baryl gets there. I love her interactions with Sisko. I like the way that this story is unfolding and just giving us more depth. You know, like you said, they started off with Bajor and being a very spiritual people, but we're also seeing that there is another side to their life, and there would have to be with the political side and the way that this goes with faith and politics, which, you know, is a huge deal in the United States, but also there's other places around the world where it's a big deal too, so it's not just here. And the way that those sometimes play hand in hand in a good way and sometimes in a bad way. So, again, I feel like it's all very even-handed, and it's showing you the good and the bad on each side, you know? So I like this episode a lot, and it's the more I watch this trilogy in Deep Space Nine, the more I'm just impressed with so much of what they do here. And, it's just well done all around.
Yeah, I enjoyed this story very much as well. And one character interaction that I love that we didn't talk about, well, I did kind of mention it briefly at the beginning, is between Quark and Odo.
Yes.
Armin and Renee together are so brilliant. Anytime they have a scene, just the two of them together, the way they play off of each other. And of course, they have a history on stage together before Deep Space Nine. And you can really, really tell. And I don't know, it's just fantastic scene there in Odo's office.
Well, Chris, I'm ready. I don't know about you, but I'm looking forward to next time when we can come full circle with this trilogy and finish it out.
That's right. Next time we'll be talking about The Siege, the final part of this, which I can go ahead and tell you is brought to you by Vidal Sassoon.
Oh, excellent. I'm excited.
Have you ever seen a military with better hair than the Bajoran military?
Really haven't. I have to say, I really enjoyed the look that they gave to Nana for this episode. It was so understated and very nice. It works better than her like Fonzie hair that she has in like the second season that I just don't get. But yeah, so glad to be brought to you by Vidal Sassoon.
Now, if we could just really get some funding from Vidal Sassoon, we could really go places
there
here.
There you go.
Network.
And we'd have the best hair of any podcasting network ever.
Then we'd have to start doing video, right?
This is true. Yeah.
All right. Well, if you want to send us some feedback on today's show, there are many ways you can do that. Of course, you can go to our website, trek.fm/contact, and use the form there. choose to send to a show, choose the orb. That'll come to both Matthew and me by email. You can find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. We have our regular page on Facebook, facebook.com/TrekFM. And we have the absolute best way for you to discuss the show with us and other listeners, and that's the Babel Conference on Facebook. Matthew, tell everyone what that is.
Well, the Babel Conference is our listeners-only discussion group, and it's great because it is only known to the listeners, which means that it's a great group to come together for all the people who really appreciate Trek FM and talk about all the things that we do on our shows. So join us over there at the Babel Conference, and you will have, I think, one of the best conversations that you've ever had online about geek things.
Absolutely, yeah. So just go and type B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up, or go to our website and click discussion. That'll take you there as well. It is a closed group, so you do need to click join. We'll let you right in, and we hope to see you over there. Okay, Matthew, when you're not having an orb vision in which you're running around naked, where can people find you?
I need eye bleach for that thought of myself. Thanks, Chris. Well, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me on Instagram at MRushing. You can find me doing Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek. Be sure to check that out. We've got some great interviews with authors as well. Just interviewed David Mack about his latest book, Seekers 3 Long Shot, so I hope everybody will check that out. Really worth your time. I also do the 602 Club, choose a great new geeky topic each week, and try to do things that, you know, new, old, everything in between, introduce people to things they might not try. In fact, last week we had John Champion and Alice Baker on. We talked about The Man from U.N.C.L.E., had a blast. So you can check us out there. And then, of course, you can find me on my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're not walking around Deep Space Nine trying to figure out exactly what you do as a deputy of Odo, where can we find you?
I'd like to be a deputy. That'd be fun.
Yeah, I think you could pull it off. Unfortunately, you don't have those shape-shifting capabilities, so you can't really turn into the chair of the guy you've been following.
Yeah, and I can't be a mouse or a rat.
That's disappointing.
Yeah.
You're an utter disappointment, well, Chris, as a deputy.
I know. I mean, I've barely gotten started, and I'm already a disappointment. So. Just think of the new heights of disappointing behavior I can rise to. So,
might as well just go to Quirks and get a drink at this point.
I guess so. You can find me elsewhere on the network doing the Ready Room with other hosts from all around the network and special guests, and we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series and also sometimes special topics on that show. We just rotate through the series, so check that out if you want to hear more discussion about Deep Space Nine as well as other parts of Star Trek, and of course Matthew is there with me on that show from time to time. You can also find me occasionally doing a Hyperchannel on the network and also behind the scenes on the official Axanar podcast. And then you can find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. My column there is called Trekspectives. My current column ties into the circle in a sense, in that I talk about how you could take the 3-episode format and apply that to the Next Generation. So you'll find that over there. Just go search for an enterprising approach to TNG. And then outside of the world of Star Trek, you can find my other podcast called Metropolis On Air, which is all about life in Tokyo and about Japan and other interesting topics. I do a lot of interviews on there. And you can find that in iTunes, Metropolis On Air, and also on the website metropolisjapan.com. And that's where you can find me. Also, Twitter, my username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. And on Facebook, same username, and I'm in the Babel Conference. So I'd love to chat with you about Star Trek over there. And one quick reminder, you can find all the shows on the network in iTunes, itunes.com/TrekFM, or just search for Trek FM in your podcast apps on Android, on iPhone, or go to our website, trek.fm, and check out Patreon, patreon.com/TrekFM. To find out how you can help us keep the shows coming.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.